Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On today's show, I'll be talking to singer-songwriter and multi-instrumentalist John McCutcheon. McCutcheon has released dozens of albums since the 1970s, and he is considered a master of the hammered dulcimer and is also proficient on many instruments, including guitar, banjo, auto harp, and fiddle. Some of his most recent CDs include Joe Hill's Last Will, Trolling for Dreams, and Ghostlight. Today, we'll focus on his new collection, To Everyone in All the World, a celebration of Pete Seeger. I'm talking to John McCutcheon by phone from his home in Georgia. John McCutcheon, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, I want you to tell us, well, I'm always curious about how people discover folk music. Tell us.
Well, in my case, I actually can pinpoint an exact day and time. I was 11 years old, and my mother made me sit down and watch the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, March on Washington, in August of 1963. It was a transformative experience in many, many ways. I'd never seen that many people gathered together at one time. I mean, nobody had. And there was preaching like I never heard in church on Sunday, and there was music like I'd never heard before. I mean, Imagine a little kid, 11-year-old kid, hearing Mahalia Jackson for the first time. But then there were folk singers, and I had no idea what folk music was. I'd never heard of folk music. I was living in northern Wisconsin, and it wasn't like we had folk groups and concerts happening there. Mm-hmm. And it was really, it was stuff I recognized as old, but profoundly contemporary at the same time. And I mean, it was there in the context of the March on Washington, when the Civil Rights Movement was, which was the dominant social movement of 1963.
Yes, yeah.
And so it, in my mind, it was connected to that as well. And the songs were powerful. I mean, other than the fact that I completely misheard the chorus of Blowing in the Wind, as the ants are my friends.
That's perfect.
And, that was the day that I said, I got to learn about this folk music stuff because it's obviously better than it sounds.
You know, that's what's amazing about folk music. It transcends generations. It speaks to people of all ages. It's amazing to me that it has lasted in that way.
Well, it's the root of all the world's music. Everything comes from it. And I can say for myself, as I've traveled the world, I've never been a tourist because I've always had my ears tuned to the music that was at the root of everything in that particular culture. And I keep stumbling on it. In the Caribbean, in Central America, in South America, in Europe, many, many different places I've been. All of a sudden you hear something, or people will come up to me and they say, I don't know what you just did, but it's familiar.
Well, you know what? I want you to tell us about your most recent CD, To Everyone in All the World, a celebration of Pete Seeger. Tell us how this metamorphosized and what Pete Seeger means to you.
Well, I heard my first Pete Seeger song at the March in Washington, Peter, Paul, and Mary sang If I Had a Hammer. And the thing that was really the most moving to me, because I'd never heard the song before, is as the camera panned the crowd, every single person was singing. I mean, young and old and black and white, up at the dais and out in the far reaches of the crowd. Everybody knew every word. My mother was singing this, and I remember looking at her and thinking, who are you? You know, how do you know this stuff? I've got a lot of catching up to do. But I didn't know anything about Pete. Didn't really for several more years until I picked up a Pete Seeger album, We Shall Overcome, the Carnegie Hall concert, June 8th, 1963. I know that because I'm looking at it. It's on my wall. It was the very first LP I ever bought, and I bought it because of the title song, We Shall Overcome, which I'd heard on the news, and it fascinated me because you usually didn't hear music on the news.
Yeah.
And this was a live concert recording. I'd never been to a concert, so I didn't know what to expect. But it was so profoundly moving. It was old songs and new songs and songs he had just come back from traveling around the South with civil rights freedom fighters and came back with a whole bunch of songs that had been spontaneously created and, like We Shall Overcome, morphed out of old hymns. And it was like opening up a box full of things that you never knew existed. Fast forward 50 years. In 2012, I did an album in honor of Woody Guthrie's 100th birthday. Woody was the first person who, you know, whose songs I learned when I started playing the guitar. And then in 2015, I did an album honoring the 100th anniversary of the death of the labor songwriter Joe Hill. Mm. And as soon as I did that album, I knew I would do one in honor of Pete's 100th birthday. It's sort of like the third leg of a three-legged stool for me. And it was a labor of love from start to finish. I invited lots of friends to help me out. And believe me, it was an easy call.
I'll bet. I'll bet. Yeah. Well, it's a beautiful CD. And I, you know, let's play an excerpt from To Everyone in All the World. And I want to play the title song. Let's listen.
Everyone in all the world, I reach my hand, I shake their hand. To everyone in all the world, I shake their hand like this. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, we can shake hands. Everyone in all the world, I reach my hand, I shake their hand. Everyone in all the world, I shake their hand like this. All together, the whole wide world around. I may not know your lingo, but I can say by jingo, no matter where you live, you can shake hands.
Tell us a little bit about this song, John.
I remember hearing this song for the first time when I was maybe 14 or 15. I was hungrily learning songs right and left, and I picked up a Pete album. By that time, I knew that if I could find a Pete Seeger album, I better pick it up. And it was an album of just little short pieces of songs, and this was one of them. It's a song he wrote, a little kid song, and I just fell in love with it as a kid. In fact, that's one of the common things about this album, with the exception of The Spider's Web. Mm. All these songs I learned when I was a teenager, and so they've had plenty of time to gestate and, you know, try on different clothes over the years, and that's why so many of them came out the way they did. With this, you know, my buddy Stuart Duncan, who's the greatest fiddle player to ever draw a breath, and I'm just sitting around doing what we do when we sit around. I'm playing the banjo, he's playing the fiddle, and we turned it on, and there you go. And Tim O'Brien jumped in on the harmonies.
Wow. Yeah, Seeger's songs are so recognizable. There's such a beautiful flavor to them, and such a, you know, it's like a recognition of the beauty of life in many ways.
Well, and they all say something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's not a lot of fluff. There's not a lot of fat on a Pete Seeger song. He knows what he wants to say. He goes out and he says it, and he's got the directness of a Woody Guthrie and the purpose of a Pete Seeger. What more can you say?
Yeah, yeah. Now, do you write songs too, don't you?
Of course.
So tell us, when did you begin starting to write, and what were some of your influences?
I started playing guitar because my best friend, with whom I did everything, got a guitar for his 50. He was a year older than me, for his 15th birthday. And 4 months later, I turned 14, and I had to get a guitar. So I had lobbied for a couple of years. He and I loved folk music, talked about it all the time, never imagined we would play it. And for my 14th birthday, I got the guitar from my dad, and I got the freewheeling Bob Dylan from my buddy.
Oh, yeah.
And here was a guy who came from a town smaller than our town, way up on the Canadian border. And yet there was a whole world in all of his songs. So I just thought, you know, when I started playing the guitar, I went down to the library, and the only book in the library that had guitar chords in it was Woody Guthrie folk songs.
Mm-hmm.
So going through this whole book, learning to play the guitar by singing Woody Guthrie songs, And it was clear to me he had written all these. And listening to Bob Dylan, and he wrote all these, and many of them in both sources were based on traditional melodies, and certainly on traditional forms. I thought, oh, well, this is just what you do. You love folk music, the traditional stuff, but you also write songs. And I started writing pretty much right away. I wrote really terrible songs. I'm still capable of writing terrible songs. I just, have better sense about what not to do on stage. But my writing has always been based on my knowledge of and love of traditional forms.
Mm-hmm.
It's, when I was starting off to playing, I would, sort of intersperse some of my songs with the traditional music I was learning. And I was out in the field. I went off as a college student, hitchhiked around the Southern Appalachians and never came back. And so I was, to use a phrase from the book, neck deep in, from the album, neck deep in traditional music. And so on one hand, I would sing this amazing song that had been worn beautiful and smooth on a thousand tongues before mine. And then my crappy little original song. And it was clear to everyone, especially me, that one was a gem and one was, at best, a diamond in the rough.
Mm-hmm.
So I woodshedded for many years, just trying to figure out, okay, how do you write songs? How do you make it real? And there were people who were out there who had obviously gone through the same process, who were thoroughly rooted in traditional music and started writing their own songs, and they worked. People like Gene Ritchie and Hazel Dickens and Utah Phillips. These were people who, could sing a trad song with the best of them, but also learned what made a song good.
Yeah. I want to play another excerpt from To Everyone in All the World. This one's called Spider, and then this is a sweet, unusual song for Pete Seeger, I think.
Unfolds a plan of her devising, a thin premeditated ring to use in rising. And all this journey down through space, in cool descent and loyal-hearted, she spins a ladder to the place from where she started. Thus I go forth as spiders do, in spider's web a truth discerning. Attach one silken strand to you for my returning.
If you're just joining us, my guest is John McCutcheon. He's a singer, songwriter, and we are discussing his new collection called To Everyone in All the World, A Celebration of Pete Seeger. Since we just played Spider, you have written actually quite a few songs yourself about children or for children. Tell us about that. It's got to be so different to try to get into that realm.
The Spider's Web was the only song that, on this collection that I actually learned as an adult. It's a lyric by E.B. White of Charlotte's Web fame. And he wrote it as a love poem to his wife.
Mm.
If I remember correctly, her name was Catherine. Pete put a melody to it as an homage to his wife, Toshi. And it's impossible for me to talk about Pete without talking about Toshi.
Mm.
I loved Pete. I adored Toshi. She was the person that made Pete Seeger, in that she grounded him in important and, I would say, essential ways.
Mm.
When people say, Pete Seeger started the Clearwater Festival, no, Toshi started the Clearwater Festival. Anybody who knows Pete and Toshi knows Pete is the dreamer, Toshi was the doer. And when it came time to do this album, Pete was not really known for love songs.
Right.
Some would argue, I among them, that every song he sang was a love song. But this was an actual carnal kind of love song, and I included it in this collection for for my wife, Carmen.
It's a sweet little song. I had never heard it. I had never heard
gem.
It. Yeah, yeah. You know, John, I want to ask you this. In one of your biographical notes, you stated that you perform and write in the spirit of moving rather than impressing people. Tell us about that. I thought that was an interesting observation.
Back in 1966, when I got that first Pete Seeger album of mine, We Shall Overcome, it was a live concert recording. And as I mentioned before, I've never been to a concert. I didn't know what to expect. And anybody who was ever at a Pete Seeger concert knows that it's the most unusual concert you're ever going to go to.
Mm.
Because you're part of the show. Pete had the ability to involve an audience in ways that was unexpected to them. Got them to do things they didn't know they could do, like sing in harmony, sing out. I know touring with this album, and I get people singing at my concerts all the time, but with these songs, I've never heard singing at my concerts. It's as though, oh, this is a Pete Seeger song. Yes. And it's loud and harmonious and really amazing. So what was different for me about hearing that Pete Seeger concert is this was something that was jointly created by the audience and him. They did things in concert with one another. I came to understand years later that most people think of a concert as one person standing up on stage showing off for everybody else.
I wouldn't say showing off for everyone.
Well,
in some ways.
Yes, you are.
Well, getting attention. You're getting attention.
You're demonstrating your expertise at something or other. But
okay.
with a Pete Seeger concert, you know, you were really moved. You came out of there feeling different somehow about yourself, about the world, about the stranger who had sat next to you.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that's what I wanted to do. Yeah, I wanted to have the chops to be able to, you know, not have someone say, well, you know, I like his songs, but I wish he could sing. Or his guitar playing was so bad, it really distracted me.
Uh-huh.
Or what is he bothered to try to do that? You know, I didn't want to have any hoops that I was asking my audience to jump through, but also I wanted to seduce them with skill, but that wasn't the point of it.
Mm-hmm. I get it. Yeah.
It was, you're inviting, you have a vision of what can happen here. And for a couple of hours in a little dark room, you got 300 or 400 people sitting there with you. What can happen?
Uh-huh.
Let's find out. And it involves risk and courage and the ability to stick your neck out, both as an audience member and as a performer.
Yeah, that makes sense.
On the best of those nights, you know, that's what I want to have happen.
Mm-hmm. John, I'm going to play another excerpt from this beautiful CD. This is one of my favorite songs by Seeger, Turn, Turn, Turn.
Mm.
A season, turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die,
a time to plant, a time to reap,
a time to kill, a time to heal,
a time to laugh, a time to weep.
Do everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, turn, turn. And a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to build up, a time to break down,
a time to dance, a time to mourn,
a time to cast away stones,
a time to gather stones together.
Tell us about Turn, Turn, Turn. You must know a little bit about the song.
Oh, well, whenever Pete and I did a show together, he always sang it. And especially in his later years, he sang it every show that I was ever involved in. I think it was prophetic for him.
Mm.
The words come largely from the book of Ecclesiastes. In fact, once I asked Pete, how do you handle the royalties on that song? I mean, did you send a check to a church someplace? Or, and he said, well, you know, I actually only wrote the last six words of that song, which is one reason I ended the song after those six words rather than singing another chorus.
Mm.
It's one of those songs that everybody knows. And like all the famous songs of Pete's, somebody else had a hit with him. The only time Pete was ever on what they called a hit parade in those days was with Little Boxes, which, of course, mm-hmm. was written by Melvin Reynolds. I mean, other than with the Weavers.
Mm-hmm.
But this one, I decided to take a really different take on it, as I did with almost every song on the album. And I invited a fabulous young band, the Steel Wheels. We have sung together at festivals, but never recorded together. So this was a real treat for me.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have to mention this because we need to talk a little bit about how many instruments you play. To tell us about your interest in becoming so proficient in so many instruments.
Well, part of it is that I was raised before Ritalin. And the other part was how related they all are in the real world. I was a college student when I convinced my advisor to let me take a 3-month independent study, hitchhiking around the Appalachian South, in order to meet banjo players.
Mm.
And, you know, in academia, you're in these little rooms and you study, you know, I don't know, 17th century French literature for 45 minutes to the exclusion of everything else in the world. And you're led through this 45 minutes by a professional teacher who's got a pedagogy and a syllabus, and it's laid out there sequentially so that you can understand it. All of a sudden, I'm sitting in Roscoe Holcomb's living room in Daisy, Kentucky, and we're just playing banjos, and I'm trying to figure out how in the world he does what he does, and he's just playing.
Yeah.
And I had to completely rejigger my way of teaching and learning. I had to teach myself how to do this. I had to pay attention. I had to listen. I had to remember, all without technology. And I would find that banjo players always hang out with fiddle players,
mm.
and maybe with guitar players. I already know the tunes from the banjo, so maybe I can torture everyone around me by learning to play the fiddle. And, oh, I already know how to use a flat pick, and the mandolin has exactly the same fingering as a fiddle. Wow. And then someone would play the auto harp, and, oh, I can figure that out. Someone put a hammer dulcimer in front of me, and my mind was totally attuned to deconstruct how this instrument is set up, no matter what instrument it was, create some kind of a method for teaching myself this after listening very carefully to people who had been playing it all their lives. So it's a little bit like someone who learns Spanish, especially when you're young. Mm. All of a sudden, Italian becomes pretty,
pretty easy. Yeah, I understand that. Let's try to get in one more excerpt from your album. This one's called Well May the World Go.
Mm.
Swing round and round when I'm far away.
Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go.
Well, may the world go when I'm far away.
Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go.
Well, may the world go when I'm far away. streams flow, blue above, green below, when I'm far away.
Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away. Well, may the world go, the world go, the world go. Well, may the world go when I'm far away.
Well, may the world go. That's another beautiful song. You know, a lot of these songs are not well known. Is that why you picked them?
No. The main reason I picked them is because I loved them. And I knew I had to do some of the more well-known songs. I had to do Guantanamera and Turn, Turn, Turn. And If I Had a Hammer. The bottom line is I had to love them. But there's a lot to love in Seeker's repertoire.
Yeah.
And with a song like Well May the World Go, I have known that song and performed that song. It's been a frequent concert opening song of mine for 40 years since I first heard it. And it's a song, it's a prayer of hope. And it's easy to get people singing on it. So it kind of introduces the ethos of the evening. Yeah, you're going to be a part of this too. Surprise. And then, you know, as far as the recording of it goes, I knew that I wanted to treat this as a bluegrass song. Oh. And Tim O'Brien, who's a member of Hot Rise, the band that plays on this, has probably been on most of my albums. Tim and I are pals from way back in West Virginia days. And again, as I said earlier, it was an easy call. In fact, I remember afterwards I'm collecting, you know, I say, okay, guys, I need your names, your addresses, and your social security number. Why do you need your social security number? Well, because for the Musicians Union pension plan, you know, when I file this and, you know, they're going to send you a check, you're going to get pension payment. And I said, we're getting paid for this? We just wanted to be on this album.
John, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information and whatever you want for so people can connect?
My website, believe it or not, is folkmusic.com. I got it a while ago, but nobody had it. So that's the easiest way. I mean, I'm touring hither and yon.
Yeah.
And you can find out where I'll be, and you can get on a mailing list. You can pick up the Seeger album or any of the 39 preceding albums there. And mostly you can stay connected.
Okay. Well, John McCutcheon, thank you so much for joining us. This has been a great pleasure to talk to you, especially about this new CD. It's beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank you. I'm so glad you like it. And thanks so much for supporting folk music.
Yeah. Thanks, John.
You're welcome.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.